Good morning. When Alan Turing, who I don't think I need to introduce to anybody here, the originator of the logical concept of the computer, when he developed what is the construction of a certain type of thought machine, it was designed to prove that this machine cannot work properly, which people always forget. So basically, there's a negative evidence. The computer is the evidence for the fact that a computer cannot prove it was right. So when Alan Turing, the father of the digital, if you like, he had ended the war, one of the code breakers, and he began to understand he would not be allowed to actually build that thought machine computer he'd developed, because people thought, since he's gay, he would be open to blackmail by the Soviets. At that time, he developed what later became to be called the Turing test, a test which claimed to clarify nothing less but the question of what is thought. I propose to consider the questions, can machines think, quote unquote. It begins with definitions of the meaning of the terms machine and think. At the very least, the first half of the question was something that Turing could really laugh about, because he knew what the machine in question was, computers that could compute anything that was computable, and which a human being could also calculate if that human being got sufficient time, even if that time would be a lifetime or 10 lifetimes or even 100 lifetimes. Computers, that is what we have today. Deep learning machines, data science algorithms, big data crunches. Michael Kosinski showed recently at Stanford that it's just enough to have 100 likes on Facebook, and you know much more about what somebody likes than even the closest relative. So what remains is the question about thinking, and that question is, what exactly is thought? The trick of finding an answer to that is a typical Turing answer, because it's a Q&A game, because on the one hand you have a human being asking a question, on the other hand you've got two combatants, a human being and a computer. They are visually and acoustically separated from each other, which means all the questions have to be both asked and answered via telex, human being and computer answers. After a certain number of answers and time have elapsed, you answer, who showed thinking, human being or the computer? Turing's legendary definition of what actually constitutes thinking, which made computers, made the definition of computers, is the decision as to how thought is articulated, expressed, and shows itself. It's not so much what it actually is, but how it manifests itself. Thinking is what appears as thought. That is deeply ingrained in the epistemology of digitality. Charles Sanders Peirce, William James, were some of the idea givers he could have copied, but he didn't. And the predecessors about his thinking about thinking, did he know them at all? Nobody knows. But even such lifelong Turing researchers like Andrew Hutchins and Jack Copeland haven't found any indication as to whether or not he knew them. His text, written in 1950, the one I'm talking about, Computing, Machinery and Intelligence, is a text that gave him the honorary title of the inventor of AI, artificial intelligence. And it actually did more than that. After all, what else is Google but a huge Turing test? All the answers that Google gives are provided by machines. And as Elena Esposito said, fantastic Italian sociologist, it's memories, quote unquote, but memories that hadn't been actually thought before. So, if you like, there are oscillation of thought. In other words, we don't need to ask ourselves whether the Turing test would still be relevant today. On the contrary, we should find that with Alexa, Siri, smartphone sensors, geo-mapping and navigation, we are already part and parcel of a Turing test, all of us. Of course, in 1950, all of this was new and quite precarious. People might have thought this was a bit of quackery. You know that computers could be more than huge calculating machines for specific tasks in mathematics, but wouldn't it be ridiculous if he had said at the time that later on people would just say, Alexa, play Weekend and Sunshine or whatever the title of a song is, and then you'd hear the comedian Harmonist or somebody, they'd have laughed him out of court. And that is why Turing, as a safeguard, discusses objections to the Turing test that people can put forward and which he immediately refutes. Eight objections are easily dealt with, but the last one is a difficult one, the argument of extrasensory perception, ESP. So it's basically a foursome: clairvoyance, telepathy, telekinesis, and Turing in ESP. Thinking, says Turing, is the kind of phenomenon where ESP may be especially relevant. So what actually would happen if behind the wall next to the machine you'd have a human being with the ability to exercise telepathic abilities, and if that person knew what sort of playing card you have up your sleeve? And Turing seriously looked into that, because by comparison, a computer would be lost against a genuine clairvoyant. I mean, there are random examples, and Turing's expertise made it possible for one of the first computers in the UK to be a random numbers generator, allowing the computer to score quite a few hits. But who knows? Maybe the machine itself would be manipulated because the spiritual medium, the clairvoyant or whatever, is able to engage in telekinetics, levitate tables, in maybe even influence a computer, extrasensory perception, telepathy, levitation, psychokinetics. Turing believes in this. I quote, the statistical evidence, at least for telepathy, is overwhelming. That's what he writes. It is very difficult to rearrange one's ideas so as to fit these new facts in. His description of this very tricky situation is described by using the Oren Mensch analogy, saying the situation could be regarded as analogous to that which would occur if the interrogator was talking to himself and if one of the competitors was listening with it, keeping his ear to the wall. Now you see, this is no longer a Turing test, but it's actually eavesdropping or wiretapping. Now, before I talk about the solution Turing comes up with for his dilemma, let me try and explain why Turing considers that ESP, clairvoyance, telekinetics, and all of that are actually facts worthy of scientific discussion. He doesn't put forward any sources, so I can only say ESP, extrasensory perception, which gives us an indication because it was first put forward by Joseph Banks Ryan at Duke University, empirical scientist, and he said that back in 1934. 10-20 years later, what he said was still legendary. C.G. Young confirms it and says it's legendary. Nuclear physicist Wolfgang Pauli, who after all discovered the electron spin, and without whom we wouldn't have silicon chips these days, he was also an admirer. He had thousands of test persons, different playing cards with different test symbols, and they all had to guess which cards would be held. And apparently, by means of telepathy, he found some particularly talented people who always pointed at the right or could name the right cards, despite everything that was statistically possible. In Princeton, they tried to replicate such experiments, completely failing at that. There were no other US-American university was able to reproduce the results achieved by him. And that should have been it as far as science is concerned. But there was this one mathematician at Queen Mary College, London, Samuel Saul. And he also did 120,000 of these experiments with cards and terms for 5 years, right into the middle of the war against Germany. And he found, allegedly, telepathic people. But decades later, most of them were confirmed as frauds. But in 1955, Turing couldn't know that. Both Turing and Saul were members of the Society for Psychical Research. That was a legendary organization aimed at exploring scientific research into the psychological phenomena starting back in the 19th century and comprising all important researchers in Europe. But all of them, of course, were people who had a tendency to like spiritualism, including, by the way, Sigmund Freud, who for many years was desperate to be accepted as a member, but actually failed. The three founding fathers, Sidgwick, Burning and Myers, like Alan Turing, were all people who'd attended Trinity College, Cambridge, and were highly regarded there when, in the 1930s, Turing did his work on computers. Myers was the person who coined the phrase telepathy, supported by the empirical research of somebody called Oliver Lodge. And it was Heinrich Hertz, no less than Heinrich Hertz, who said, if not he himself, it would have been Lodge who would have discovered the electrical force, which was then called radio waves, radio telegraphy in the Great War, but afterwards radio waves. And that is something which still carries our electronic signals. And that brings us to the crux of the matter. This is the basic epistemological chaos, looking at electricity, its effect, and its media from the 19th century into the early 20th century. So telegraphy and radio both caused this chaos. From 1850, electric telegraphy is in operation in both Europe and the US. From 1870 onwards, we have under oceanic cables, without anybody being able to explain what the physical effect is that would allow us to explain electricity. But through telegraphy, first in the US, then in the UK, a new variant of spiritualism had entered. That is what we call modern spiritualism. It had numerous mediums where you could knock at Ouija boards and what have you, claiming to have contacts with the deceased, all proclaimed as serious science from people from all sorts of academies, all of which were under pressure because people in power, governments, and the populations in our growing industrial nations all clamored to know what about these airwaves and what about this ether, which is something which is tough like diamond. It goes through everything, but as a medium, interference also helps carry forward electromagnetic waves. That was Thomson, Helmholtz, Hertz, Lodge, the leading elite said that radio waves were actually air waves or interferences. But why, after all, should the spirit of the dead not be somewhere around as well and be something that telepathic people could be sensitive for? Back in 1884, Lodge already discovered the pattern of all the following expert opinions. Thought transference is something which Lodge also continued. He put the an agent drawing a figure or maybe a circle with a cross in it, and behind that the receiver, and the receiver then had to draw exactly what the agent had seen, but of course both of them being silent without exchanging a single word. Hundreds of experiments of this type can be found in the Proceedings of the Society of Psychical Research, published in the volumes 1884 following. As far as Lodge is concerned, who later had Gladys Osborne Leonard, who was one of the mediums he used to communicate with his deceased son. At least he claimed he could communicate with his dead son through her. And for him, that was a clear evidence that thought transfers actually worked. He said that thoughts aren't something that people keep in their minds, it's actually something which is oscillating in the airways, weakly maybe, but something which somebody who is sensitive can receive. So thoughts transmitted as a radio program, mental radio, as some people would call it later. In 1927, the matter finally gets into the radio on the 18th of February in the BBC. Lodge goes into a studio, sits down, and asks the listeners to put their ears very close to their radio sets. And then Lodge said he would imagine something, and the people with their ears pressed to the radio set should draw what Lodge was thinking and send in. It all goes dreadfully wrong, but the broadcast became a legend. Only a few months later, very few months later, the whole thing gets repeated in Germany. In Funkstunde Berlin, Radio Hour Berlin, 16th of September 1927. Again, negative results. Trying to read cards that way does not work. All of that is critically described by one of the originators of the broadcast, namely Alexander Herzberg, one of the co-founders of Gestalt Psychology in Germany. And he said, while the clairvoyant mediums, which might exist, did not necessarily appear among the participants of this broadcast, which means there was nothing proved or disproved about clairvoyancy in this experiment. And I'm coming to the end now, because we learned that after the modified pattern of a spiritual test, that is the pattern followed by the Turing test. It's all about transmitting thoughts from an agent to, now, of course, two receivers, namely to the computer on the one end and the human being on the other. The great forecast, if you like, of Turing is that this setting was aimed to prove computers can think. But to go back to the origin of this test, which was a telepathic scene, to try and organize it like that, Turing only thinks of one solution. He says it's necessary to put the competitors into a telepathy-proof room. That would separate all requirees. The most important question, however, remains unresolved. If we don't know what telepathy is, if there is something, then at the end, there is only one thing we can do. The Turing tests and all the applications that we have from computers don't work if you have a profit involved. Computers can only work on the basis of the thinking that they themselves develop, because it's only... We have a double sound feed in the interpreter's booth. Your interpreter regrets, but hearing two conversations makes it impossible to interpret.
Very much.
Und Wahrscheinlichkeitsalgorithmik. Das Digitale ist aprophetisch.
Try to continue. By definition, the digital channels has nothing to do with clairvoyance. And Turing himself no longer worked on computer theories in the end, but he worked on biological self-determination and mathematical, biological morphogenetics. And there he describes the embryology, which is in a mathematical way, and he also looks at simulation and forecasts of autopoietically self-organizing growth elements. Starting with his very early texts written when he was still a teenager, down to his very last works, it is very clear that Alan Turing's prophecy until this early day was always that somehow, sometime, somewhere, it will be calculable. What we call life and sense and mind and spirit is something we will be able to compute. That's why we developed the computer, but he said, with a computer, that cannot be achieved. This is a prophecy which is an anti-prophecy, and that is his legacy.